who imagined God, such is the history of the world. That, in a nutshell, is the atheistic position that there is no supernatural creator. It's a statement almost verbatim from an atheist by the name of Charles Smith. The idea is that 13.7 billion years ago, there was a tiny substance that cannot be accurately described in any modern day terms because the scientists who claim that it was there don't know how to describe it. They call it the singularity, the original ball of stuff that supposedly exploded in what is called the Big Bang. 13.7 billion years ago, that original ball of stuff that they say was 10 to the negative 26 centimeters across, much smaller than you could see with your unaided eye. You would have to have something like a very, very high-powered microscope to see it. 13.7 billion years ago, it exploded and brought into the universe time, space, and all of matter and energy. Supposedly, that matter and energy was concentrated all in a single element known as hydrogen, but that hydrogen spread out into the universe and became stars, and in those stars were cooked all of the elements that we have today, and those stars exploded and launched those elements out into the world, and that is how our universe arose. We won't need that PowerPoint at all for this lesson, so you can go ahead and let me see what I can do here. This will be perfect. You got that off? Great. That's the idea of evolution, of atheistic, materialistic, cosmic evolution. That, unfortunately, happens to be the official teaching of our public school systems today, happens to be the official teaching of virtually every organization of higher learning in our country. As I'm standing here talking to you this afternoon, 80% of all of the professors in colleges and universities are avowed atheists that would stand by that statement and say, yes, that is a scientifically factual statement, and that is the origin of our universe. Now, there's another idea. Dare say you're fairly familiar with it. It goes something like this. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God divided the light from the darkness, and the light He called day, and the darkness He called night, and evening and morning, day one. Day two, subsequently, God made the expanse, or what is commonly referred to as the firmament. Day three, God creates the flowers, grass, and trees, all vegetation and flowering plants. Day four, sun, moon, and stars. Day five, birds and fish. Day six, animals and man. And on day seven, ceasing His creative activity. Supernatural creator. There is a being that is outside of nature that by His divine power spoke the world into existence. An intelligent being, a being that could construct a universe that works like clockwork, a being that is of such higher mental capacity that that being could put into play laws that would perfectly orchestrate how things would work in this universe. Those are the two ideas, basically. Mindless chance processes from nothing or a supernatural intelligence. Now, what you're told is that there is a battle between religion and science. And people who believe in religion, they don't feel the need to defend their belief with any rationale. They feel like the idea that they've got a warm, fuzzy feeling in their heart that they call faith is good enough. And religion should just be something that you accept without justification. And the people who are claiming that this idea is what religion is all about say that science is very different. They say science is experimental. Science is something that you have to reason through that is based on evidence. They say science and religion are diametrically opposed. They're polar opposites because religion you don't have to rationally justify. Science you have to rigorously test. And so they try to suggest to us that there's a battle between science and religion. That's not true. In fact, there is a battle against science and some false religions, but there has never been a battle between science and true religion. What I mean by that is, if I were to stand here this afternoon and say, there is a God, let me show you how I know that, and I were to quote Bible verses to you, anybody who understands the Bible to be the Word of God would say, that's right, amen, we appreciate that. If a person didn't understand the Bible to be the Word of God, we could try to then show them the evidence for the inspiration of the Bible and say, you should believe this because the Bible is inspired. But you don't have to do that. In fact, the truth of the matter is, if you solely wanted to direct your attention to the available physical evidence without ever alluding to the Bible one time, you could certainly establish the fact that there is a supernatural creator. And that's what we're going to do for this particular lesson, this particular seminar that I'm going to present, especially this one, all next 45 minutes or so. We're not going to need the Bible. In fact, we're not going to need anything that most people would call religion. Now, of course, I would argue that religion, true religion, is simply following the evidence where it leads, and you're going to see exactly where it does lead. Now, if you were to ask the simple question, what's the most basic, fundamental scientific law in existence? Let's think about scientific laws just before we get started. A scientific law is a law that scientists observe, study, name, but they don't make it up. You understand what I'm saying there? What I'm saying is, okay, let's say that I've got my cell phone right here, and I throw my cell phone up. Which way is it going to go every single time I throw it up? Oh, it's always going to come down, isn't it? Now, that's because there's a scientific law of gravity that says that things are going to move toward the center of our Earth at 9.8 meters per second squared. Now, if I throw this up 100 times, which way is it going to go? 1,000 times. Million times. I move to Hawaii and throw it up 100 times. I go up to Florence, Alabama. Y'all did some real good advertising to get me down from Florence, Alabama, didn't you? Go up to Florence, Alabama, throw it. Guess what? Every single place I go, doesn't matter how many times. Now, what if you don't like that? What if you say, you know what, Kyle? I don't like the law of gravity. It's giving me some problems. I mean, the law of gravity is causing my face to kind of sag a little bit. I'm getting kind of wrinkly. And, you know, my arm muscles just aren't going the direction that they used to go. And I don't like the law of gravity. You know what, Kyle? I got a problem with it. Every time I get out of my bed in the morning, I put my foot out of the bed and my foot goes down every time. You got that problem too? You know, wouldn't it be cool if when you got out of bed, you put your foot out of bed and it just hovered there? In fact, you wouldn't even have to step on the floor. You could just kind of scoot yourself out of bed and you would just hover over the floor. You could just kind of swim through the air to the bathroom where you could brush it. Wouldn't that be neat? What if we said, guys, how many of you are fed up with the law of gravity? All right, I'm fed up with it. All right, let's call a million of the most brilliant scientists in the world and let's vote on it. Million of them. We pack a million of the most brilliant scientists in the world and we say, all those that want to change the law of gravity, say all million of them and myself say I. And the 150 of you that are here, a million and 160 people say I. Now, all we need to do to prove that we have changed the law of gravity is get a volunteer to step off a 20-story building and we've got it covered. We got any volunteers? Well, we just, a million people, not enough? 2 million? Let's say we take all 7.5 billion people in this world and every single one of them votes to change the law of gravity. How effective is that going to be to change the first decimal place of the force of the law of gravity? Doesn't matter, does it? You can study it all you want. You can name it. You can work with it. But you can't change it, can you? Now, scientific law is something that does not change. That's why it's called a law. Because in nature, no one has ever seen a singular exception. Never once. If there ever were an exception to it, guess what it would no longer be? Wouldn't be a law anymore. It would be something else, a postulate or some other scientific name that left open the possibility that you might could adjust this. Scientific laws don't change at all. Now, there's one fundamental scientific law that we have used in every single science experiment for as long as humans have been around on this earth. It's the most fundamental scientific law in the world. You use it for every single experiment, and you guys use it on a regular basis. You don't know that you're as scientific as you are, but you do use it on a regular basis. Now, work with me through this hypothetical situation. Suppose that you are sitting in your seat and you are listening to me speak, and I am so eloquent and am such a good communicator that you're not thinking about the kid next to you or behind you. You're not thinking about what you're going to eat after this. You're not... Now, like I said, this is hypothetical, but work with me. I mean, suppose that really was happening and you were paying such great attention. All of a sudden, this songbook shot across the room going 95 miles an hour, crashed into the back exit sign, blew it into 150 pieces, blew the book into 892 pages, and your eyes got as big as saucers, and you whipped around and you looked at me and you said, "Kyle, what caused that?" And I said, "Oh, that's a real good question. Nothing." Sometimes songbooks spontaneously shoot themselves across rooms at 95 miles an hour and crash into exit signs. It just happens. It spontaneously occurs. There's not one single thing that you can look to explain the occurrence of the songbook. It just happens spontaneously. There's no previously existing cause. And you call Buddy Shaw up and you say, "Buddy, I don't know how or where you found this guy, but you need to send him back to Alabama, especially before the Alabama-Texas A&M game. You need to send him back because he doesn't know a thing." Would any person in this audience today accept the idea that a songbook spontaneously shot itself across the room at 95 miles an hour? No. Here's why. Because you might not know how scientifically minded you are, but every single person in the world understands the most fundamental law of science. That in nature, if you see a material effect, it has to have a cause that came before it or was simultaneous to it, and that was greater than it. Translation, books don't spontaneously shoot themselves across rooms for no reason. It just doesn't happen. Now, suppose I said, no. I mean, that book doesn't spontaneously shoot itself across a room for no reason. Here's what really happened. A dime-sized housefly plopped his housefly 0.001-ounce body on the edge of that songbook and catapulted it across the room at 95 miles an hour. Is that any more believable? Now, we got a cause that came before it, but what's the problem? It's not big enough, is it? Do you know that when you ask the atheistic community, okay, you're posing to us the Big Bang, supposedly started with a tiny ball of singularity 13.7 billion years ago. Where'd you get that ball of stuff? Richard Dawkins has a book. He's probably the world's foremost atheistic writer and speaker and thinker. In his book, The Grand Design, he says, "I'm a biologist. Physicists tell me that you can get the stuff. I've never really studied it. I just take their word for it." Go to the physicist. Where did you get the first ball of stuff? You know, generally speaking, most of them don't want to answer that question. When they do, let me explain to you. Now listen to me with a straight face. Here is their current answer. That original ball of stuff came from nothing. Now, used to they played word games with the idea of nothing. You can play word games with the idea of nothing fairly easily. If I were to say, "What am I holding in my hand?" Nothing. If I were then to say, "Now most of you believe in God. What is stronger than God?" Nothing. So what I'm holding in my hand is stronger than God. You see how you can play word games with a word like nothing? Now that's a common, a common fallacy, logical fallacy called equivocation, when you take one meaning and you put another meaning on it and you play word games with it. Let me show you the kind of word games that people in the past have played with the concept of nothing. One man that was very integral in writing several aspects of the currently understood Big Bang model said that the pre-inflationary universe, that tiny ball of stuff, came from nothing. And then they said, his name is Alan Guth, they said, "Dr. Guth, came from nothing, could you describe nothing for us?" He said, oh yeah, it was really small. They said, really small, could you help us out? He said, oh, it would have been 10 to the negative 24 centimeters across. It only weighed 25 pounds. Suppose I come up to you and hit you as hard as I can in the face with nothing. Do we have a problem? Well, no, we don't. In fact, in reality, I just hit all of y'all in the face with nothing. I hit you with nothing. Now suppose I've got a dumbbell on which I have written in bold white letters nothing that weighs 25 pounds, and I come up and punch you in the face with it. And you say, through a broken, bloody nose, Kyle, you just hit me in the face with a dumbbell. I said, no, you're mistaken. I hit you with nothing. And I hold up the dumbbell that says nothing. If we call something nothing, does that make it nothing? Oh, no, Abraham Lincoln, I believe, is on record with this one. He said, if you have a dog that has four legs and a tail, and you call its tail a leg, how many legs does it have? He said, it's got four. You can call its tail whatever you want to. It's still a tail. You understand that if you say it came from nothing, but then you say that nothing was actually something, all you're doing is playing word games. Now, that was in the 80s and 90s. They have taken the next step to the absolute absurd. And let me tell you what I mean by that. Man by the name of Stephen Hawking. Stephen Hawking has Lou Gehrig's disease. I don't know if you've ever seen him. He's recognized as the world's leading theoretical physicist. You understand what I'm saying by that? He's recognized as the most brilliant individual in the entire world. When he goes to speak somewhere, tens of thousands of people tune in to listen to a computer-synthesized voice that comes from a computer that he controls with half an inch of skin on his right cheek. That's all he can move. He came out with a book called The Grand Design. In the book, The Grand Design, Stephen Hawking said, suns cannot spontaneously generate. They can't pop into existence out of nothing. Black holes cannot spontaneously generate. They can't pop into existence out of nothing. Now listen, the world's leading theoretical physicist, here's what he said. But universes can. He said, our universe is here because it spontaneously popped into existence out of nothing. Now listen to me. There is a fundamental law of science, a law of cause and effect, that says if you see a material effect, you have to have a cause that came before it and that was greater than it. And he has just violated the most fundamental scientific law in existence. The second law that he has violated is the law of thermodynamics, the first law of thermodynamics, the conservation of mass and energy. You cannot get mass and energy from nothing. You can change its form. You can take a log and you can burn it and turn that log into heat energy and light energy into ash, and it will dissipate into the atmosphere, and that energy will get less usable and it will change forms, but you don't add new energy and mass from nothing. And yet with a straight face, the world's foremost theoretical physicist said, we got it from nothing. Now, is it any surprise to you that the scientific community would try to contend that religious people are not rationally thinking through their ideas and scientific people are, and yet to get the current scientific idea, you have to violate the two most fundamental scientific laws that we know? Now, how scientific is that? In fact, I was debating a man by the name of Dan Barker. Dan Barker tried to follow this line of reasoning. He tried to suggest, yes, you can get a universe out of nothing, and basically what I informed him of is the very same fact that I think all of you are coming to conclude here. So what you're saying is that originally there was an entity of some sort that did not behave in a way that matter behaves now. Oh, you're saying that there was an entity of some sort that didn't obey the current laws of nature. You're saying that there was an entity of some sort that was not natural, but It's hard to get out, isn't it? You're saying there's an entity of some sort that was supernatural, that was above nature, an entity of some sort that had powers that nature does not have. Guess what? We've been saying that for years. And that's as scientific of a conclusion as any that there is. Now, here's the next problem for the atheistic idea. The first is they can't get the original stuff, and to postulate the original stuff coming from nothing, which is what the world's leading theoretical physicist does today, is as unscientific as unscientific can get. The second problem is something that we understand. Look, a housefly plopping his body on that songbook, it might be a cause that came before it, but it's not big enough, is it? You don't get the mighty, muddy Mississippi from a frog hopping into it, do you? You don't have a UPS truck with a couple trailers on the back of his truck there, driving all I-65 is the road I drive all the time. I don't know what the highway is down here. I-35. Oh, yeah, all right. You got I-35. You got a UPS guy. He's going up at, let's say, 60 miles an hour or so, 65 miles an hour. All of a sudden, he comes to a screeching halt, does six flips, ends up in the ditch. Oh, you think, what in the world caused that? If you're thinking scientifically, if you're not, you think, wow, spontaneously, that just happens. Well, you pull over, you got your cell phone, you get out, you dial 911, you go over to the guy, you say, are you okay? He says, yeah, I'm all right, thankfully. You say, okay, great, what can I do for you? He said, you got to get everybody off the road. I said, you got to get everybody off the road? Why? He said, they're all over the place. You say, what's all over the place? He says, it was about 25 yards in front of me. I couldn't do a thing about it. I couldn't turn, I couldn't get out of the way. You say, what was 25 yards in front of him? He said it was the meanest, most dastardly looking, menacing mosquito I've ever seen. Planted right into my grill. Caused my truck to do six flips. You call 911 back. You say, we got some serious head trauma. A mosquito's not going to do it, is it? Do you know the universe that the atheistic community is trying to explain from that tiny ball of stuff? Let me just give you some numbers here to try to help you see the unscientific nature of the supposed scientific idea of atheism. Our universe, about 200 years ago, they thought it was pretty big, thought it had several million stars. A little while later, they said, no, not several million stars. It looks like it's got tens of millions of stars. A little while later, they said, you know, tens of millions of stars, not really even going to touch it. It looks like it's got billions of stars. A little while later, they said, well, hold on just a second. We're seeing something out there that's not even a star. It's a galaxy. In fact, it looks like it's got millions of stars in it. And our current understanding now is that there are an estimated 100 billion galaxies. Listen to me, 100 billion galaxies, and every one of those galaxies has an estimated 100 billion stars. Oh, hold on just a second. Did I say an estimated 100 billion? We live in the Milky Way galaxy for years and years and years. In fact, I think several decades, they suggested to us that there were about 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. They said, well, we think we've miscalculated. There are 300 to 400 billion stars in the singular Milky Way galaxy now that we think. Let me just try to help you get your mind around that. If you wanted to get up and count to 10,000 every day, I don't know why you'd want to. The other day, my son, he gets up earlier than the rest of us. He's 9, my oldest, and he got up and, it would be Saturday. We'd get to sleep in. He'd wake up 6:30 or 7 and do stuff around the house. Well, that morning, he woke up earlier than us, about an hour earlier than us. I said, Drew, what'd you do this morning? He said, I counted. Counted. I said, what were you counting? Just in my bed counting. What'd you count to? 3,000. You ever counted to 3,000? It took him, I think, 30 minutes, an hour. I don't know how long it took him to count to 3,000. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You know how long it's going to take you? I don't know. You know, I've never gotten the itch to wake up and count to 3,000. Just hadn't. But if it does, if you want to get up and count to 3,000, let's say you get up and count to 10,000. All right, let's say you do that. Do it every day for a week. 70,000. Every day for the next week, 140,000 you've counted to now. Next week, 210,000. You count to 10,000 every day. Now, let's say you could count the stars, 10,000 of them every day. You know how long it'd take you to count to 100 billion? Now, that's what they used to say was in the Milky Way galaxy. Now they say there's three times that. So I'm going to have to update my calculations because I used to calculate on 100 billion, and it's going to take you 27,450 years to count to 100 billion. Now, multiply that by 3, and that's how long it's going to take you counting 10,000 every single day to count the stars in our one galaxy out of an estimated 100 billion galaxies. Now, our sun is a middle-sized star. You can put 450 Earths into the sun. No. Let me take that back. You can put 1 million Earths into the sun. Our sun's a middle-sized star. You can put 450 suns in some of the larger stars. That means you can put 450 million Earths inside some of the stars. Now, how big is our universe? Well, let me see if you can wrap your mind around this. Our universe, they suggest to us, is 20 billion light years across. Now, a light year is the distance that it takes light to travel in a single year. You ask me, how fast is light? Well, it's pretty fast. A little faster than I can run, just a little. You know, about 186,302 miles per second. That's the speed of light. That means if you were to turn on a flashlight and it had an unimpeded beam, it could go around the equator of the Earth 7 to 8 times in a single second. That means if you let light travel for 1 year, it will travel 586 quadrillion miles. So, if you could travel from one end of the universe to the other end, of course, they've never seen the ends. They're just saying we think we might have seen where the end might possibly be. We don't know. It could be that we're saying 20 billion light years right now, and 2 years later, we're going to say 40 billion or 60 billion. But if you could travel from one end of the universe to the other, and you could travel the speed of light, 186,000 miles a second, it would take you 20 billion years to travel across the universe. You say, wow, Kyle, it's hard for me to get my mind around. Okay, don't worry about even getting your mind around the universe. Let's just get your mind around one galaxy. The Milky Way galaxy. We live in the Milky Way galaxy. You know how you remember that? Candy bar, man. I mean, you know, what other galaxy? You got Andromeda galaxy up there. And then there's the Milky Way. Oh, yeah. Well, you can remember that. Sure, that's what we live in, the Milky Way galaxy. You know how big the Milky Way galaxy is? Let's say, now this is hypothetical. If you've ever seen my old Camry, you would know this is hypothetical, but let's say we took my 1997 old Toyota Camry. It had 236,000 miles on it, and we souped it up to be able to travel the speed of light, and we made it a hatchback so that everybody in here could get in it. Like I said, hypothetical, but we're going to get in my old Toyota Camry that's traveling now the speed of light, and let's just say for kicks that it flies, and we're going to fly across our one galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. And we're going to go the speed of light, 186,000 miles, like, you know, you got the G-forces all slamming on your face. How long is it going to take you to get across one galaxy or one galaxy? We're not even an extra big galaxy, about average. 100 years traveling the speed of light? Well, that'd be good, wouldn't it? I don't have that kind of time. You know, I'd be 135. Probably not making it. Some of you would be 136. 200 years? 1,000 years? You understand if you could travel the speed of light to get across our one galaxy, it would take you 100,000 years. Traveling the speed of light to get across a singular galaxy. And where'd that come from? Tiny ball of singularity that was 10 to the negative 26 centimeters across. Anybody ever seen something that could get you that kind of a universe from a tiny singularity that you said popped into existence from nothing, violating the foremost fundamental law of cause and effect? No. Isn't that why the psalmist in Psalm 19 said, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utter speech, night unto night utters knowledge. There is no language, no voice where their sound is not heard. You know what that means? That means if you lived 3,000 years ago and you looked up into the night sky, you could understand that there had to be something bigger than this universe. That means if you lived yesterday and you looked up into the night sky with the Hubble telescope, you would understand even more forcibly that there had to be something bigger than the universe. Now, the atheist says, well, yeah, but if you guys are claiming that there's a God that put rinky-dink humans on the earth, and the earth is a tiny rock in the middle of billions and billions and billions of miles of space, what about all that wasted space? Hasn't God wasted a lot of space? Well, I mean, it depends on what you call wasted. What was God's purpose in making all the extra stuff? I'll tell you why. Psalm 14, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Do you know what you have to do to come to the conclusion after you see all of the stuff out there that there is no God? You have to totally and completely throw out all rationality and every bit of scientific thinking to come to the conclusion that there's not a God. You see, that space out there is not wasted. That space is put there so that what Paul said in Romans chapter 1, verse 20, since the beginning of creation, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things which are made, even His what? Eternal power and Godhead. How do you get a universe that's 20 billion light years across without a God? Oh, guess what? You don't. You can't. It's unscientific. It's wrong. Now, there's something else that you know that causes some very serious problems for the Big Bang. Not only does it violate some of the most fundamental scientific laws, but there's something intuitively that you understand that the Big Bang model violates. Explosions don't cause order. They cause disorder. You understand that just as sure as you're sitting there. Suppose that I had all of the pieces that I needed for a working laptop computer. Now, the other day I was at the University Church of Christ in Montgomery, Alabama. I didn't ask the elders before I did this. It was probably wise. I probably would have got shut down on it. But here's what I did. I took an old cell phone and I took it up to the podium. And I had a hammer and I smashed it into a bunch of pieces. Now, I got about 400 kids out there watching me smash this phone with a hammer. Their eyes getting big as saucers. I picked up that phone, and I had a box, cardboard box. Put it in the box. I said, now, guys, how are we going to get this phone back in working condition? Pulled out a firecracker. I said, this is a firework. It's minor explosion. Let's see what happens. Lit it. Close it up. Bam! Opened it, dumped it on the table. I said, that didn't work. Let's try it again. Picked it up, put it in there, closed it up, blew it up. Oh, I think I might have done that 2 or 3 times. You know how many times I got a working phone out of that? 1 out of 5. It wasn't bad. You don't believe that, do you? Maybe I didn't blow it up enough. Maybe 1,000,000 times. Now, the problem there is we've only got one big explosion, so they would have to say it all got right the very first time. Although, as absurd as it sounds, Stephen Hawking says, actually, there are an infinite number of universes, and they just keep popping into existence from nothing. And the reason that ours looks so well designed is because we just happen to be lucky enough to live on the one that looks designed. There are a bunch more out there that we can't see that aren't well designed. Oh, yeah, well, give me some scientific evidence for that. There is none, of course. But the problem that you're running into is that you've got a world that works more fascinatingly, that is so intricate. It works better than any machine has ever operated. It's the finest tuned machine in the world. In fact, let me tell you how fine-tuned it is. So fine-tuned is it that the atheistic community has had to come up with an explanation for it. And they've called it the Goldilocks principle. You know Goldilocks. Goldilocks and the Three Bears. All the Three Bears walk into their kitchen one morning and their porridge is not the right temperature. Now, I always stop this story right here and say, why do you eat porridge anyway? You know, I've never had porridge at my house, and I guess there might be a time when I would welcome a big, hot, oh, delicious-looking bowl of porridge, but I've never seen one of those. In fact, everything that I've ever seen that calls itself porridge looks like you could feed it to the horse outside and he would make a good meal out of it. But these bears are somehow eating porridge, and the porridge is just too hot. And so they decide they're going to go on a walk, and Goldilocks comes in, and she sits down at the first bowl of porridge, and it's too hot, and the second bowl of porridge is too cold. But baby bear's bowl of porridge, what is it? Just right. Then she moves to the chair, and Daddy Bear's chair's too hard, and Mama Bear's chair's too soft, but Baby Bear's chair, just right. She goes upstairs to the beds, Daddy Bear's bed too hard, Mama Bear's bed's too soft, Baby Bear's bed, just right. You're starting to see the Goldilocks principle? Things look like they look like they're just right. What do you mean by that? What do you mean when you say things in the universe look like they're just right? Oh, well, here's what I mean by that. There are, and you can get these from the atheist community. You don't have to get them from the creation scientist, although there are several of them out there that have honed in on this fact. You can get them from the atheist community. You understand that our Earth goes around the sun right now. Oh, it's traveling, I think, about 77,000 miles per hour, something like that. It travels as it goes around the sun on its axis. It's tilted at about 23.5 degrees, traveling on its axis about 1,000 miles an hour. And it takes 1 year for the Earth to make an elliptical orbit around the sun. Now, we say elliptical orbit, but it's very only slightly elliptical. It would almost look like a perfect circle to you, but it is just slightly elliptical. And here's how slightly. Our Earth goes around the sun, and as it does, it veers from a straight line by 1/9 of an inch every 18 miles. Wow, Kyle, thank you. That is so helpful to our understanding. You know, we really appreciate that. 1/9 of an inch every 18 miles, you say, Kyle, what does that do? Well, it gives us the perfect elliptical orbit for an atmosphere on Earth that allows life to live. You say, could you adjust that? Yeah, you could if you wanted to. I mean, we don't have the power to do it, but if somebody did have the power to adjust the 1/9 of an inch every 18 miles, suppose you wanted to say, all right, we don't like 1/9 of an inch. We'd rather adjust it 1/10 of an inch every 18 miles. Now, that's just a little bit less than 1/9. Just a little. Okay, so instead of it moving toward the center 1/9, it's going to move toward the center 1/10. Just a little less. Oh, well, what's going to happen is the average distance for the Earth from the sun is about 93 million miles. If it only moves 1/10, at least twice a year, the Earth is going to be so far away from the sun that everything that we know that life needs to exist is going to freeze to death and life's not going to be able to exist on this planet. You move it by 1/10 of an inch instead of 1/9. You say, I don't like cold weather. I live down here in Texas. I said, well, I don't really like cold weather either all that much. Let's make it 1/8 of an inch so we get a little closer to the sun instead of a little far away. Okay, great. Yeah, I'll do that. And burn yourself up twice a year so that everything that life needs incinerates twice a year. Do you mean to tell me that the elliptical orbit of the Earth around the sun is so finely tuned that if you adjusted it by less than 1/10 of an inch, life could not exist on the Earth, and guess what? Contrary to popular belief, the Earth is the only place anybody's ever seen life. You understand what I mean by that? There is a PhD you can get in astrobiology. You can get a PhD in astrobiology. You know what astrobiology is? Astro meaning star, biology meaning life. Astrobiology is life in outer space. The government, about 5 years ago, when I was writing this article for our Apologetics Press website, spent $90 million to supplement PhD programs in astrobiology. That's like getting a PhD in what, underwater basket weaving, maybe? Not even that, because you can really underwater basket weave, I guess. I've never seen anybody do it, but you might could. There's no such thing as astrobiology. You mean you spent, as a U.S. government, $90 million to supplement PhD programs to study life in outer space and nobody's ever seen any life in outer space? Yeah. And you mean to tell me that life on this Earth hangs from a thread that is so thin that if you adjusted the elliptical orbit of the Earth by a tiny fraction, that life, the only life that is known in the entirety of the universe, would come to an end? Oh, yeah. And that is just one of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of examples of the Goldilocks principle. Let me explain to you another one. Now, this one, I don't even know how to explain. I'm going to give you the numbers. I'm going to let you deal with them yourself. I don't even know how to explain it. There are four forces in the universe. That is it, as far as physical forces go. There's the strong atomic force, the weak atomic force, the electromagnetic force, and the force of gravity. And that's it. Now, the electromagnetic force and the force of gravity correspond to each other so that if you altered one of them, you would alter the other one. Now, if you changed either of them by a tiny fraction, then the things that hold life together in our universe would no longer be able to hold life together. And now, here's what I mean by a tiny fraction. If you're looking with me and you have a decimal point right here, and then a zero right here. Let's say you have a decimal point and a one. What does that one stand for? 1/10. So that means you got a hole, you bust it up into 10 pieces, and you take one of those and you have 1/10. Now, if you got the decimal point and you have a zero, one, what's that stand for? 1/100. That means you take something, you cut up into 100 pieces, and now you got one of those. getting progressively smaller by an aspect of 10 each decimal point that's added. We understand that. Okay, so now we've got 0.001. You're cutting a hole up into what? 1,000. 0.0001. 10,000. 0.00001. 0.00000001. Man, you'd be sharp if you got that. Listen to me. You couldn't adjust them by 0.00000, put 40 zeros and a 1. And if you adjusted the electromagnetic force or the force of gravity by that tiny of a fraction, everything we know that would hold the universe together for life would not exist. And how do you get there? Well, you just throw all the pieces in a box and you stick a stick of dynamite in and you blow it up, don't you? You guys know the absurdity of that. You can't get the order that we have in this universe, and that's the universe. What I mean by that, when I say the universe, that's the stuff out there. I mean, you're talking about the big forces of the universe, but there's stuff all over the earth that we understand you can't get from explosions. Now, William Paley used the argument and analogy very, very forcefully, didn't he? When he said, if you walk into a forest and you look down and you see a rock, you don't think that any human intelligence had to be behind forming that rock. But if you look down, you see a stopwatch. And you pick that stopwatch up and you see that it works well, and you pop the back off of it and you see the gears and the cogs, and you see that there has to be a power source that's turning those around, and the hand moves at a spur at a perfect rate of a second. Well, that's got to have some type of designer. We understand that, don't we? You don't get a watch from a huge explosion. You could get that sound from an explosion, but not a watch. 1976, Denton, Texas. This was one of the most monumental events probably in the last, you're looking at 6 decades. Man by the name of Thomas B. Warren, member of the Lord's Church, had a PhD in philosophy from Vanderbilt University. He was probably the most credentialed member of the Lord's Church alive at the time. He was debating a man by the name of Anthony Flew. Most of you probably don't understand the import of that. I didn't for years. In fact, I've just come to appreciate it. Anthony Flew, for the last 60 years, has had the singular, most widely distributed, most widely read, most widely commented on philosophical paper in the entirety of the world. For the last 60 years. He wrote a paper. It was about 1,000 words long, not very long at all, The Presumption of Atheism. He said, in The Presumption of Atheism, you know what? You should start every scientific inquiry thinking that there is no God, and that will help you understand our world better. He presented that at the Socratic Society over which C.S. Lewis was presiding in the 60s. And from that time, that's been the most widely published, downloaded, read, distributed atheistic philosophical paper in the world. To say that Anthony Flew was the world's leading atheist is not an exaggeration. It's not hyperbole. It's not a stretch. I'm telling you, it's the truth. Now, he was debating Thomas B. Warren in Denton, Texas. They were in a 4-night debate, 2 hours every single night. We don't have those kind of debates anymore. Now we have one night debates for 2 hours, and that's it. 5,000 people a night came. In fact, Anthony Flew, in one of his books that he wrote when he was in his 80s, said it was the most people he spoke to at any singular time in his life, 5,000 people a night in Denton, Texas. Thomas B. Warren used a ridiculously complicated argument. I mean, in fact, I'm not sure I understand it completely, and so to bring it down to you guys, I mean, and what I mean by that is, if I don't understand it, I sure can't explain it. And so I'm not sure I can help you guys understand it, because if I don't understand it, y'all can't get an understanding from it if I don't get it. But let me see if I can put it on layman's term. A human hand's designed because a prosthetic hand we know is designed. Oh, wow, seems real complicated, doesn't it? Let me show you how it works. Thomas B. Warren put up a picture of a prosthetic limb, an artificial hand. He said, Anthony Flew, did that artificial hand have an intelligent designer? Artificial hand, prosthetic limb. No, I guess it was about 4 years ago. They came out with a 10-pound metal alloy arm that they attached to a 26-year-old Marine shoulder. It was the most advanced piece of prosthetic engineering and technology that anybody had seen up to that point. They took nerves from her shoulder and hooked them to motors in the arm so that when she thought about it, she could actually and literally move the metal fingers of the arm. Now, if I understand it correctly, when they would attach a certain nerve to a certain motor, she would think she was moving her thumb and she would move her pinky. And they had to get her to process it correctly or readjust it so that she could think she was moving her thumb and move her thumb. They said, this is unbelievable. We've never seen anything like it before. She can hold a jar of spaghetti and with the other hand hold a spoon and scrape out the remaining spaghetti sauce. It's thrilling, they said. We've never seen anything like it. She can fold a pair of pants without having to use a hard surface. She can just hold them up and with both her two hands fold them. That's amazing, isn't it? Dr. Kuchen, the guy in charge of the research, said, but it's still clumsy. Compared to what? Huh? Your hand. Cost $4 million. That's not counting the time that it took the researchers to come up with it. You're talking just $4 million of construction. You didn't know your arm was worth so much, did you? $4 million, and you wouldn't trade your regular old human hand for that, would you? Thomas B. Warren, they just had little pencil sketches. Didn't even have PowerPoint back in 1976. Go figure. Had a little pencil sketch of an artificial hand. He said, Dr. Flew, did this hand have a designer? What's Dr. Flew got to say? He's got to say. What's he got to say? Yeah, we all know you don't get a prosthetic limb from an explosion. Now, Thomas B. Warren put up a picture of a human hand. Just a regular old human hand. And he said, Anthony Flew, did this hand have a designer? Take a hammer to that prosthetic limb. Bust a couple of the fingers and come back in a couple of weeks. What you got? Busted fingers? Take a knife to some of those wires. You cut them. Come back in a couple of days. What do you have? Cut wires. Accidentally cut your finger. In a matter of seconds, one of the most complicated blood clotting cascades that has ever been devised starts working perfectly so that the blood clots right where your finger is cut, but it doesn't clot close to your heart so that it kills you. And within seconds, it is clogged up enough so that the closed system of blood circulation can continue to function and you don't bleed to death. Oh, take that hammer, smash a couple of your fingers. Guess what? Your body is so well designed that if the pieces of the bone where you smashed them can't be put back into place, your body dissolves those. You mean to tell me your body's got the ability to dissolve bone? Sure it does, but why isn't it dissolving the bone in your fingers at the present? Because it's perfectly programmed only to dissolve the pieces of bone that need to be removed, and any that are still functional, it doesn't dissolve. And many times if you happen to break your finger or your arm and you come back in 6 weeks or 8 weeks, where you broke it is stronger than it was before you broke it. Now, I wouldn't recommend going out and breaking your arms to make them stronger, but it happens to be the case. Dr. Flew, did this hand have an intelligent designer? Nope, he said. Now, before you judge his answer too harshly, this was acceptable grammar for someone from Britain in 1976, but here's what he said. Thomas B. Warren said, how'd it get there? Dr. Flew said, it just growed there. It just growed there. Just grew. Songbook just shot itself across the room. That was in 1976. I was born that year. Dr. Flew came out with a book. Oh, I believe it was 2006. He was about 82 years old. He talked about that debate that he had. The title of the book was, There Is No God. And the no was marked out. And there was an A written above it. So that the title of the book actually was, There Is a God, How the World's Most Notorious Atheist Became a Believer. And at 82 years of age, Anthony Flew said, I am the most distinguished atheist in the world. I've got the singular, most widely distributed atheistic philosophical paper for the last 6 decades. And I have been wrong. He said, I have looked at the world and seen the intricacies and the details and the complexities of life enough to know that it could not have come about by mindless chance processes. Now here's what I like to think. Now this is just Kyle Butt's take on Anthony Flew's conversion to belief. I like to think that right after he debated Thomas B. Warren, he got up the next day and he picked up his toothbrush and his toothpaste and he looked at his hands as they squeezed the perfect amount of toothpaste out of that toothpaste tube and right onto his toothbrush. And he watched in the mirror as he brushed his teeth just hard enough to get all the teeth fuzz off that morning, but not hard enough to do any gum damage. And I like to think that in his mind he heard Thomas B. Warren, how'd it get there? How'd it get there? How'd it get there? How'd it get there? Nerve-wracking for 20 seconds, isn't it? Think about that for 35 years. And eventually he woke up and just said, I cannot accept the unscientific conclusion. It just grew there. I can't be rationally honest and do that. You do understand. This is the tip of the proverbial iceberg. We could do this all day long. Literally, I could stand here for 14 hours explaining to you in detail the hundreds and hundreds of examples of the anthropic principle. I could do it for hours. Do you know the scientific conclusion that an honest, rational person is forced to come to, looking at the evidence? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That, my friends, is the scientific conclusion. I sure appreciate your kind time and attention for this first session of our 4-session afternoon today. The next idea that we're going to be dealing with is evolution's thinning ice. Some of the most commonly used evolutionary evidence that is being presented in schools as a reason why kids should believe that they evolved from primordial amoebas, and I'm going to show you why that's just simply not the case. Let me take about 5 minutes to go over just a few things that I think you might be interested in. On the back tables there, you're going to see several different resources. Lots of those resources deal with exactly what we discussed in this lesson. This book, How Do You Know God Is Real, is a book that deals with, on a 3rd through 6th grade level, exactly what we just discussed in this particular lesson. I have 2 debates that I have done with atheists. These guys are some of the leading atheists in the world. They wouldn't be in the top 5, but well, I guess Dan Barker would be. This one that I did in 2009 was on the campus of the University of South Carolina. It was a debate with a man by the name of Dan Barker. Dan Barker is the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the largest atheistic organization in North America. They have about 18,000 members. They've got a bankroll of about $33 million. They're the ones that sue people to get prayers out of schools. In fact, I was just there in Florence, Alabama. They came down to Florence and sued the Brooks High School right outside of Florence, about 5 miles outside of Florence, because they were saying a prayer before the football games, and the Freedom From Religion effectively shut that down. The Ground Zero Museum, where that cross was supposed to be put in the museum, the group that came to sue the city of New York to keep that cross from going into the Ground Zero Museum, Freedom From Religion Foundation. We had about 550 people that could fit in the auditorium in the University of South Carolina, had about 850 show up. If our estimations are correct, there were about 25,000 people that watched this online the night that it happened, and that was in 2009. What I need you to see from that is the interest that our country is showing in this particular kind of topic. 5,000 people a night met in Denton, Texas to hear Thomas B. Warren and Anthony Flew. 25,000 people listened to this, watched it on their computer. Last year I had a debate with a guy by the name of Blair Scott. This is not it there. It's out there. It's the Scott, but Scott debate. We had that debate on the campus of the University of North Alabama in an auditorium that would hold about 1,700 people. It was filled with about 1,650. It wasn't filled with about 3,000 because lots of people understood they wouldn't get a seat if they didn't get there an hour early, and so they just decided to watch it on their computer. We estimate that about 50,000 people watched it live and then subsequently have passed out thousands of the DVDs, and it's on YouTube. I don't know if it's on YouTube yet, but it will be soon. And that's a debate we had in Florence, Alabama last September on the existence of God. There's one book out there that goes with the Butt Barker debate. When I debated him, they're two-hour debates, so you can't get through everything in 2 hours. So what we did was we put the transcript of the debate. It's called The Christian's Guide to Refuting Modern Atheism. Put a transcript of the debate, and then everything he brought up in the debate, we answered in the remaining 200, 220 pages of the book. So basically, you take the debate, you can read the debate there, and then you go through and see all the answers that are there to anything that he brought up, and that's there. Apologetics Press is a nonprofit organization. It's been that way for the last, you're looking at about 33 years. Here's what that means. We lose money every single year. We're great at it. We're professional money losers. That is why we're nonprofit. And here's what that means. If you look back there and you see, let me give you an example. The other day, this book, the first about three chapters deal with what we just went over. The next four or five deal with what we're going to go over in the next lesson. This is what I call just your standard basic creation book. The other day, a lady called me from a school up in Tennessee. She said, I've got sixth graders in this public school. She's a member of the church. She said, can you come speak to them? She had about 100 of them. I said, yeah, sure. Came up and spoke four or five times on dinosaurs, what we're going to discuss in the next lessons after this next one, and gave every one of them a book. Gave 100 of these books out and left about 40 Dinosaurs Unleashed books. Didn't charge the kids a thing for these books. Just said, here, you can have it. Now, that's how we lose money all the time. We give these away. We sell them for $15.95 or $10.95 or $9.95 or $2, whatever we can sell them for, because we want them to get into the hands of people that can use them. So what I'm telling you is, I have packed plenty, and if I hadn't packed enough, then I'll ship some more down here. If you say, Kyle, I can put 30 of these in a school system in Marlin, Texas, I'll say, all right, how much can you give me for them? Can you give me $1 for them? $2? $3? Okay, whatever you can give us for them, great. You take them and you put them in the school system. We don't care about the money. Somebody's going to come up with the money. We want this material in the hands of people that can use it. And if you can come up with a way to put it there, then we'll make sure you get whatever materials you need to put it there. If you got any questions about the material, you let me know. If you say, Kyle, I can put 5 of these in the library here in the wherever, the public school library or the public library or whatever. Okay, great. What kind of deal you want on? Let's get it done so that we together can get this information into the hands of the kids who need it. That's what we're talking about. Sure appreciate the elders for letting me be here. And we're going to take about a 5-minute break, get you some water, stretch your legs, and we'll be back in here for Evolutions Thinning Ice.